Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Welcome again to Democratic Perspectives. I'm Steve Williamson. Sitting across from me in a different chair than he normally sits is...
Shaking it up again. That's kind of it's what I do, Steve, but we're glad to see you back. Steve Williamson is back here. My cousin Tino here, and we're going to talk about...
Mike is our co-host, and we have here, and we promoted Gary from producer to senior. First class producer.
A title. I've always wanted a title.
We're up in your title,
and
Gary.
I gave him my chair.
Super producer.
Yeah.
We'll be talking the New Deal between the United States and what's called the P5 plus one nations, which is pretty much all the large nuclear powers, that including Russia and China and Britain and France. And they have cut a deal for the framework to limit Iran's nuclear weapons possibilities. It's a major, major story. It's frustrating to see the news where it's buried under two or three other things, and whether it's liberal news or other. This president has called it
historic. The NCAA takes precedent over
and celebrities.
Unless the war starts tomorrow.
And
it better not start on tip-off.
It is, as the president said, a historic deal. It is a major, major thing.
And Steve, the only reason it's a historic deal is because we're talking war here.
Right.
Right?
There's one of three possibilities.
One of three, yeah.
So what's happened, folks, is that this is a much better deal than all the skeptical experts thought was going to happen. Now, you won't hear this from the Republicans who are saying it can't be a good deal because it was done by Obama.
That's right.
Yeah. And that's true of everything. So it can't be good because it's Obama. We hate everything he does and everything his administration does. And they're all no good. There's not a good person in the administration who can do anything at all.
The Obama derangement syndrome.
The Obama derangement syndrome. So there are those folks. There's a lot of bombastic nonsense coming out of them. But the experts, including a lot of people who are very skeptical of the agreement, are really surprised that it's as strong as it is. It is much stronger than anybody predicted in terms of controlling Iran's ability to make nuclear weapons. Yep. No one expected this comprehensive a framework. Almost no one. I think literally across the board, all the people who've been thinking about this expected a much weaker agreement. It's much stronger than anyone affected. What I think, now remember, if you're an expert and if they cut a deal and you say, oh, it's a great deal, well, nobody needs you anymore. But if you're an expert and you say, well, I have some doubts about it, and then they're going to come tuck you under the chin and try to talk to you, you know, and stuff. So there's an advantage. There's a political and career advantage to being skeptical about everything and to being negative about everything, because then, you know, you get a response. So what really happened in these negotiations that even the people who are favorable to them, believe them favorable, that no one is saying? And what I think it is this deal shows that Iran has really given up the possibility of making nuclear weapons anytime soon. Now, they say it'll lengthen it to a year. In other words, if they break the agreement and go for nuclear weapons, it'll take them a year. But a year is not just time. A year is the amount of time and also inspections and everything else needed to do something. In other words, I guess I'm not saying it clearly, it's also a matter of what can be done. It's not just a year. A year gives you another 2,000 windows or whatever it is into what they're doing.
They'd be giving up a lot of the fuel they've already developed. They'd be giving up the right and ability to develop plutonium.
Right.
They would be giving up most of their centrifuges.
They're giving up 14,000, Gary, out of 20,000 centrifuges. They're only going to be able to use in production really old models. They're giving up 97% of their enriched uranium. They're going from 10,000 kilogram stockpile to 300 kilograms. That means they have to make a whole lot of stuff. They either have to destroy or export the core of their plutonium plant and replace it with something that can't make nuclear weapons. They're allowing walk-around inspections of their centrifuge production facilities, which nobody thought they would do.
Daily inspections of their entire process.
And the whole Iranian nuclear supply chain is now visible and will be examined. They're required to get pre-approval of all sales to Iran of any nuclear-related equipment. I mean, it's an astonishing deal. I think the reason that the Iranians did it, and the reason they went as far as they did, is they want the sanctions lifted. They see their power being increased through economic means, don't you think, Mike?
Oh, without a doubt. As they move all over the region, as the, George Bush made Iran the biggest player, something I will never understand. But Iran is such a player in the region, and so they see their future as economic rather than military. And their security is secured, and I believe this is what John Kerry went into negotiations with. And we got to remember the guy that was doing the talking was Kerry and staff. Obama, was on the phone back in Washington. I just want to give credit where credit is due. This is an historic deal. This is a big
John
deal.
John Kerry is one of the most proactive Secretary of States in American history.
Exactly.
And with this agreement,
he's
one of the most successful Secretary of States in American history and probably a candidate for a Nobel Peace Prize.
But the idea is that Rand used to sit down and say, look around and say, if you don't have a nuclear weapon, look at the powers that have a nuclear weapon. Pakistan, India, Israel. If you have a nuclear weapon, you don't get invaded by George Bush.
It's tempting to have a nuclear weapon. That's what you're saying.
So it's better to have one. Now they're saying, these years later, they're saying it's better not to have one. We will have the world taking care of us, at least militarily. It's better to have the ultimate weapon. Israel has the ultimate weapon. If they ever use it, then Israel is annihilated by the rest of the world.
The thing I'm thinking about, Mike, is that the asymmetrical stuff. For those of us who are interested in fairness, you have a whole bunch of nuclear power telling a smaller country of 80 million people that they can't have nuclear weapons. Their prime enemy, I suppose, is Israel. And Israel has hundreds of nuclear weapons that could threaten them.
At best guess, about 400,
And why is one Iranian nuclear bomb an existential threat to Israel and hundreds of Israeli nuclear bombs are not an existential threat to Iran?
Because, and I can hear people pulling their hair out at home right now, because Iran has vowed the destruction of Israel, and I'm publicly, and I don't believe, I could be wrong, but I don't believe Israel has vowed to destroy Iran.
That's true.
Publicly.
That's true. And that probably is the best argument for it. I just wanted to go through a few more little facts. Iran will now, the way things work, folks, is that different levels of uranium can be used for different things. They're going to be limited to enriching uranium to 3.67%, which is enough to run a nuclear reactor and heat stuff. Not enough to make a bomb, which you need about 90%. Again, their stockpile has been reduced. Their nuclear facilities are all under inspection. What I'm a little bit worried about, and I see what you guys think, is that I would like to see the inspectors go in, find that Iran is following what they're doing, and immediately lift most of these sanctions.
Yes.
And the reason is you want to show to the Iranian people that cutting this deal has been good for them. And the idea that you can have a stingy, slow, careful, foot-dragging release of the sanction seems to me absolutely counterproductive.
I agree. The here's the backroom deal I want to see. I want to see Kerry tell the Iranians, look, recognize Israel. That's the only way this deal could mean. The only way, and I call him the psycho, but you know that may be a little prejudicial. But I'm talking about Netanyahu. The only way Netanyahu could make this deal better is by having the Iranians recognize Israel as a state. Don't forget this.
I think he's thrown that in just to destroy the deal, though. In other words, he's throwing in a last minute demand just to destroy the deal.
The only people against this deal, you know, let's be honest, are right wingers here in the U.S., the conservative right leadership in Iran. The people of Iran are highly in favor of it. They were celebrating after the framework was announced.
Iranians and
Netanyahu and his clown-like friends in Israel.
They want a closer relationship.
Iranian people are probably the most pro-American people in the Middle East. That's the irony. Even though the government is bad, there was the Green Revolution, and the Iranian theocracy managed to crush it. But the population age, the demographics are getting younger and younger, and the younger people really are disengaged from this. That an attack on Iran would just bring them all into patriotic fervor.
I love the Reuters article that talked about what George Bush failed to do militarily, Obama has succeeded diplomatically.
The other thing is that people are saying, oh, well, Saudi Arabia will be terribly upset if we make peace with Iran. Well, too bad, you know. I mean, it's better, and there's a good article in the Atlantic magazine, and you know, it's better if we, historically, we haven't played them against each other, but we have two allies, two people that we work with in the Iran and Saudi Arabia. That's what worked for us. Having just Saudi Arabia and being dependent on a country where produced a tremendous number of anti-American, anti-Western fighters and terrorists.
You can use the word here.
Yeah.
And 9/11, 15.
Yeah. 15, yeah. 15 out of the, 19?
Yes.
Yeah. So having balancing Iran and Saudi Arabia. Secondly, we have no business identifying, supporting Sunni Muslims against Shiite Muslims. The Iran, for folks who know, is a Shiite Muslim. It's a big division in Islam between, and there are many smaller divisions, but it's a big division that is like the Protestants and Catholics at the height of the Hundred Years' War, when everybody's fighting everybody, and everybody is claiming it's about religion. Well, a lot of times it's about power. But we have no stake in that. We don't, you know. And if Iran is going to help fight ISIS, I mean, okay, you know, I mean,
we're now somewhat allies.
They're saying, ISIS. Oh, Obama did something terrible, right, Mike? Because now Iran has so much influence in Iraq. Well, who invaded Iraq with a Shia population that had been persecuted by Sunnis, who Iran had protected and supported all this? What did George Bush? I don't think they thought about anything. What did they think was going to happen? Who did they think was going to end up having influence in Iraq?
Blind into Baghdad was the best article I read in 2003 before George Bush, and it was in the Atlantic Monthly, which I'm going to talk about right now. Atlantic Monthly calls this whole thing a Cold War. You know, we've had a Cold War between the United States and Iran for a long time. The benefits of ending that Cold War, one of the many benefits, besides peace and stability in the region, besides a working economy for Iran, is you win the hearts and minds of young Iranians. We saw that clearly.
Now, most folks don't know, but in 1953, the United States and Britain used a covert operation to throw over a man named Mohammed Mossadegh.
Well done.
Mossadegh.
That's work.
And what was he doing? What was his crime, Gary? What was he doing that was so terrible? Was he a dirty communist or what?
He was the democratically elected president of Iran. That was one. That was his first crime. His second crime was that he tried to nationalize the oil fields.
And take
him away from U.S. and British interests.
And so we overthrew him, and we installed installed the Shah, who was never popular with the Iranian people. He installed his father.
Brutal dictator.
He was a brutal dictator. And he was a part of a whole bunch of brutal dictators that back, in the 50s and 60s, there was no critical thinking at all. We had Chiang Kai-shek was a great, great guy. Syngman Rhee in Korea was another one. Diem in Vietnam. All these people had almost no support. All of them were violent dictators. And all of them were given this gloss by the American propaganda and media without any criticism.
During the Cold War, our diplomacy consisted of the enemy of our enemy is our friend. That was the primary. The Dulles brothers started that in the 50s, right. and it became the kind of watchword of the.
So the Iranians have a long memory, right, Mike? Going back to what we did, overthrowing their democratic government and installing this guy they didn't like for decades.
Right.
That's how the Cold War with Iran gets started.
Well, if we want to list, yeah, we can list the American Empire moves. But exactly. But the other good thing about ending the Cold War, besides the cheer by winning the hearts and minds of the young Iranians, is that you couldn't do, other than with lots and lots of American bombs and lots of American lives, is decrease the power of Iran's hawkish leadership. You know, those guys, those people in Iran that hate Israel and don't want peace any more than Netanyahu does. We haven't talked about that yet, but Netanyahu never wanted peace. In fact, there is no route to peace that will please Netanyahu.
Almost nobody watching the international scene has ever thought that Netanyahu, although he pretended to want to make a two-state solution with the Palestinians, was ever going to do
it. He's
been dragging it out, expanding the settlements, trying to make any kind of peaceful settlement that doesn't mean domination and persecution of the Palestinians and demographic craziness for Israel because of the absorption of a huge Arab population on the West Bank.
He finally admitted it in the run-up to his re-election. He admitted that he would never allow a two-state solution.
It's what everyone always suspected who followed this. The other thing is he ran a racist campaign. It's as if in the United States you said, oh, white people, you have to get out and vote. There's a whole bunch of black people turning out at the polls, you've got to get out, or the black people are going to take over America.
We haven't done that.
Yeah, well, we've done it. But the point is, that's how he ran the campaign, and I think the man has been a racist from day one, and certainly a lot of information in his early life about his racial views is available. But Netanyahu. So you have Iran, who has twice now elected a moderate president. This is the second one. The first one couldn't do anything because of the reactionary hierarchy who runs Iran. So he tried to do stuff and be more peaceful, and they couldn't do it. And they threw him out, and they had this extraordinarily aggressive anti-Israeli guy in. They threw him out and didn't reelect him, and now they have a new moderate. What's his name?
Hassan Rouhani,
a new moderate president, and now this deal is possible. So the Iranians, when they get a choice, which is not very often since the hierarchy of their theological state has to approve any candidate, has elected moderate. While the Israelis, who have a free-floating great democracy and a beautiful country and done a great job and everything, have elected a racist demagogue and thoroughgoing scoundrel. I mean, everybody in the international affairs knows that Netanyahu is not to be trusted, that he's a liar and a fraud, and that you can't do it. And there was a little conversation one time that they caught on a microphone, and I've forgotten who it was talking to Obama. And the guy said to me, oh, my God, I can't stand dealing with Netanyahu. It's just awful. And Obama said, well, I have to talk to him even more than you do. So that's real, folks. That's the real take on him. So you have this beautiful country that's done so much.
And it's not just
so
Democrats that feel that way, by the way.
Right. Yeah. That's done so much. And then they elect this scoundrel on this racist, fear-mongering campaign, which is something democracies, right, Mike, are prey to, is this kind of fear-mongering driving our politics.
Well, one of them is free speech, and then you have that, but... But I don't want the point I want to underline again, I guess I made it, is that with the ascending economy, the power of the theocratic people,
control
in Iran diminishes greatly.
Yeah.
And so you achieve, once again, you achieve diplomatically what you couldn't achieve militarily, even if you bomb the crap out of them, you know, a generation from now, they're going to be back with a fresh set of hatred, and the United States has a new enemy. I mean, peace is a. I mean, when did peace become such a bad idea? When did peace become such a terrible
and negotiations?
And negotiations
the alternatives
and
are so terrible. I mean, bombing them. I mean,
I'm missing
basically
it.
The Netanyahu government wants the United States to take the fall, take the hit for attacking Iran. If they still hate us because of Mossadegh, then what would happen if we attacked them or allowed Israel to attack them? We'd have hatred for a generation. And the thing I see, Mike, is I see the economics improving. See, folks, in a stale state, the theocracy leaders have more power.
That's right.
If the
Mike
is saying, if the Iranian economy improves, the businessmen, the scientists, the stuff will grow in power.
The middle class
in Iran will be revived and grow in power, and that will undercut the power of the theocrats.
Let's talk about the alternatives to the deal, I think, you know, there's a lot of confusion over, you know, what could happen, what the choices are. On one hand, you have the framework and hopefully a written agreement by June 30th, which we've already kind of detailed. And the second choice is to continue or increase sanctions. And almost every foreign policy expert says that it's going to be a long time. It's going to be difficult to hold the sanctions in place that Russia and China and some others may break the sanctions.
In other words, if this deal falls apart, why should China and Russia stay in it? It's only our pressure and talking to them. And because
even
they don't
Russia
want,
and China, not the American Republicans, but Russia and China can see a really good, can see Mideast deal like this, could see Obama's deal as being a really good thing.
But if Congress destroyed the deal, then why would Russia and China stay
and they're
in?
They're trying really hard.
And the sanctions have, you know, they've brought so far, because everybody in the world was united, they brought Iran to the bargaining table, which was what they were hoping to accomplish. Nevertheless, during 20 years of sanctions, Iran was able to develop a substantial nuclear program. So increasing sanctions is only going to increase the pressure in Iran to get a bomb so that they can defend themselves against the rest of the world.
And it is one thing to remember, folks, it is perfectly legal for any country in the world to have a nuclear program. A program that's not weaponized. It's perfectly legal. They have every right to do it. There is no basis in international law or fairness to tell them that they have to completely destroy their entire nuclear process. That's not for us to decide.
If it's for peaceful purposes.
If it's for peaceful purposes. And the only reason that they're in any trouble legally is that they signed an agreement not to produce a nuclear weapon, an agreement, for example, that Israel never signed and went ahead and produced nuclear weapon.
Pakistan.
So if the complaint is based, one, on not liking the Iranian government, which none of us like. I remember during the Green Revolution in Iran, I was on Juan Cole, I was on his website a lot posting about the election, fraudulent election that the last guy got in, the guy before the last. And you know, we had a bunch of Iranians running in and who I think worked for the Iranian government, telling, getting mad at us and all this stuff. And I finally posted this thing, and I said to him, I said, look, this is not exactly American imperialism central. If we don't believe your election is fair, if we don't like your policy, and we're the liberal, we're the guys who see both sides of things. If we think you're completely wrong, then, you know, wait till you see the other guys, right.
So if you don't like the deal,
right,
and you admit that the sanctions are not a long-term solution, which they aren't, then what is your third choice? Your only other choice left is military action. Well, as Fareed Zakaria pointed out in his program yesterday on CNN, is that military action is, this nuclear program is so diverse and spread throughout the country and near population centers, you couldn't, it's not like a simple one, you know, strike event or even a six strike event. It's, as Mike said, all out war.
I think Americans believe that. I think they believe so much in our military might and our technology and our sophistication that if the choice is, like you're saying, a few days of bombing the crap out of them and it's all over, or we make this deal and their economy gets better and we don't have to do that.
The other thing is that
and
for all the claims that they're a threat, they're actually not really able to retaliate. That's what they really think.
A war against Iran does so many bad things. I mean, of course, there's always the nuclear option, which we could wipe it off the face of the map. But do you think, you know, Russia and the other nuclear, you know, nations are going to sit by and watch that? I don't think so. If we go in with airstrikes, it will make Iraq and Afghanistan look like child's play.
Right. I mean, how well did the Iraq war work out? Yeah. That looked like a simple thing. We'll go in there, we'll roll over Saddam Hussein's
right.
large,
looks
but
simple.
Primitive. It looks simple. How did Afghanistan go?
We'll go in there,
we'll get bin Laden out, and we'll, and now we're still here, 12 years later, and we're now trying to control the Afghanistani government.
And Iran has a stronger military than either of those.
Yeah.
And the worst part of this is you have to consider is that it will in all likelihood unleash the Sunni Shiite war to the nth degree and spread throughout the entire region.
And we're talking about many, many countries fighting each other. And already there are many countries that are fighting each other. We're talking about incredibly, one of the things that American foreign policy counts on is stability. In other words, the stability is important for them to be able to use their influence to be able to keep things going. Without a deal such as this, without a two-state solution, then the region, all of those countries in that region become so unstable. The reason we're talking about, and that's really detrimental to national security, our national security. That's the connection. The isolationists, the Republicans, the isolationist Republicans want to say, and isolationist Democrats want to say, hey, just let them fight it out. It doesn't work that way anymore. The reason we're talking about this, folks, is because right here in the Washington Post, we got this incredibly, the liberal Washington Post. At least, I guess, apparently I must be missing something.
The Washington Post is not what it was
in the 60s and 70s. That is so narrowly focused, but it said, this is a bad deal. And it listed the reasons why it's a bad deal.
Washington Post is editorial policy is under right-wing neoconservatives. They're the same people who got us into the Iraq War, who stayed in Afghanistan long after it didn't make any sense, who have been meddling in affairs everywhere, bombing people and making us enemies all over the Middle East. These same people are opposed to this war. What is their track record? Their track record is getting the United States in wars that cost us billions of dollars and get our people killed.
Good point. And that we are not of unlimited wealth. Those things that they are taking away from us, our education, our jobs, are all sorts of things because of the cost of foreign wars.
Another thing to keep in mind, as Steve pointed out at the beginning, is that this isn't simply a negotiation between the U.S. and Iran.
Yeah.
This is the U.S., Great Britain, France, China, and Russia representing the world.
That's right.
And for us to unilaterally pull out of any agreement, and we've already talked about the bad alternatives, for us to pull out of any agreement that the other four entities have agreed upon, or five counting Iran, only, you know, kind of separates us from the world.
The rest of the world, without a Bill O'Reilly, without a Fox News, has voted Barack Obama, most influential man in the world, seven times. Popular. Thank you. I'm trying to think of a word that doesn't sound like
the,
a.
Yeah, I think what Mike is saying too is that right. The
rest of the world recognizes
leadership.
He recognizes his. They recognize his direction.
All these countries have signed off on the deal, folks. It's not just the United States. It's not just the Obama. If you hate Obama really bad, it's not just the Obama administration. It's a very conservative government in Britain, a very anti-Iranian government in France.
Without a doubt.
And they've all signed off on the agreement. So and pretty much every respected expert in the world has thought it's a good drink.
But Mitch McConnell.
But you have these bomb-throwing, bombastic people who oppose it.
John McCain, bomb, 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 Iran.
It's astonishing the level of intellectual corruption of the Republican Party.
Good word.
Where we
good
don't word. The intellectual corruption of
I
the
like
Republican
that.
Party, where we don't have the wise Republicans of the old days
who put the country first. These guys are putting you talk about ideology and politics. These guys are willing to put that weight before the country every time, which is really scary. That should scare the crap out of everyone.
Well, I think it's the corruption and go to Gary on this, but the corruption is the willingness to denounce a perfectly good deal that's much better than anybody
that saves American lives, that makes America money.
For political reasons to bash the Obama administration.
And it seems to only be the current, Obama deranged Republicans against it. Jim Baker was on CNN yesterday. Jim Baker, he of Bush and Reagan fame, the consigliere of the Bush family, was on, and he is former Secretary of State and served a whole bunch of roles in Reagan and Bush government. He's in favor of the deal, and recognizing the stark alternatives that, as we mentioned, the other two choices are terrible. And so even yesterday's Republicans are in favor of the deal. It's the, what I call T-publicans, the Tea Party plus the conservative, the really conservative Republicans that
dangerously mindless, aren't they, Gary? I mean, they're reactive. They don't like Obama, so this deal can't be good.
And
they don't like Obama, so nothing he does can be good. It doesn't matter. Look, I think, Gary, Mike, I think they would have said exactly the same thing if it had been a bad deal or a good deal somewhere in between.
A perfect deal.
They would say a perfect deal. So it was an absolutely perfect deal. I think they would have said exactly the same thing. Their claims and demands are ones that Iran shouldn't really meet, which are that they cannot have a peaceful nuclear program like everybody else can have. It's asymmetrical. It's unfair to force them to not have a bomb when everybody else negotiating with them has nuclear bombs. But that's the way it is, and it's best for Iran, right, Gary?
Keep in mind that, and I'll say one last thing about the Republicans, is that keep in mind these are the people that, when fact-check, have proven to tell the truth about 18% of the time. And I mean, they're inveterate liars. I mean, the entire array of conservatives right. against it, you know, they lie more often than they tell the truth.
You've heard us say on the show many times that one of the reasons the Democratic perspective was born was because we were just shocked at you know, none of us were used to the out and out lies. But lying works so well because of the fractured media. You know, it's, you know, Walter Cronkite isn't sitting there. And if you, for whatever reason, you wanted to, you found out from another station, you know, Bob Schieffer would be giving you pretty much the same story. That doesn't happen anymore. Lies work, and they're never taken back.
They're buried.
They never have to take.
They're buried, Mike.
And
they're buried in the text.
You get all the.
They're buried in the text, aren't they?
And they
so
are buried.
Somebody
in the
will
text.
Make this bombastic, truly false statement about that there nothing's happened to the centrifuges, and I've forgotten who it may have been.
That's the
Cotton.
Post.
Yeah, you have a copy of it.
Yep.
Yeah, and it's just false. I mean, it's checkably false.
The editorial board of the Post.
Why doesn't it have any effect, Mike?
Because it does, because people are the public sensitized by Bill O'Reilly and Fox News and they're willing to believe any lie that they. I want to get in this thing about Gorbachev that you're going to hear comparisons of the president of Iran to Gorbachev. The realization Iran is saying, looking around, saying at the world, they're getting their head out of the clouded religion thing. You have a real statesman, or at least somebody that has an awareness of state politics on the earth, and saying, a deal, an economy. Life is short. These young people deserve a chance. All of the reasons why a deal is good for
Iran. He was elected on that basis.
All of the reasons why a deal is good for the United States. I mean, if we're not in the business of doing good things for other countries, this is really good for us, just like Gorbachev in the late 80s was good for us.
Yeah. It's like if you look at the younger populace of Iran, you know, Iran mirrors the U.S. in many, many ways, except for its really, you know, theological government. And one could argue we're at the cusp of that in the U.S.
But that's another show.
But it's a highly educated, worldly, young population in Iran that wants to engage with the rest of the world. They're entrepreneurial. Their culture is entrepreneurial. They want to be part of the world economy. And for us to divide up on tribal, what's going on in the U.S. is, and the reason the lies work is that if my tribe tells a lie, then it doesn't matter. I'll excuse it because it's my tribe. And so as long as you never retract the lie, you keep telling it and keep telling it. Eventually everybody in your tribe believes it. And then it gets spread along lines of independence and a lie becomes the de facto truth.
That's why, Gary, isn't it?
Very good.
What you're saying,
very good, Gary.
Yeah. What you're saying is, that's why, say, the neoconservatives who got us into these wars that were so destructive to the United States, and they're still ongoing, that their invasion of Iraq, their false information that they gave the American public, got us into a war that has helped create ISIS, for example. So it's still ongoing. And what you're saying is that the fact that they've been wrong over and over and over again seems to have no effect on the Republicans at all.
Who's the leading Republican candidate for 2016? Another Bush.
The fact that they learned nothing from Vietnam, they learned nothing from Iraq and Afghanistan, they've learned nothing from these interventions, yet they're still treated as like big authorities. I mean, Krugman's always complaining about in economics. These guys have been wrong and wrong and wrong and wrong, and they made all these wrong predictions, and yet they're still treated like they're really the smart guys.
Okay, let's cut off 20,000 hours of discussion here and say, Hillary, Jeb Bush, got to be Hillary, period. Got to be. But are we so devoid of leadership that we can only go to two families?
Yeah.
Two families in the entire United States?
It's horrifying to me, honestly.
Yeah. It is.
And to think of a third
Bush. It is like
Bush.
A third world country when we've got
Well, that's
two
it.
Families.
I mean, that can't happen. So, like I said, there's only one choice right now. And it's Hillary. I'm okay with Hillary, but I just, as a guy raised in an American democracy, we got to be able to find more than two families,
and we've got to have more range. And I mean, I think we see in Hillary in the same way we saw in Obama. Now, I like the president. I think he's done an extraordinarily good job in a lot of ways, but he was always. He never really examined the fundamentals of American foreign policy, our worldwide systematic intervention every time we see a problem. Now, there's an event going on in Yemen now, which is a huge chaotic situation. Right. Saudis are bombing the Yemeni people, and it's a fight between Shiites and Sunni tribes, basically. The United States stayed out of putting boots on the ground there. And that's what the neoconservatives want. They're busy,
that's right.
If you look at it, they're busy criticizing Obama's small footprint because we've been forced out of Yemen. The problem was the president really never examined in depth how we disengage from the world where it's useful to disengage. We're not disengaging from everything, but how we balance things and think before we act and participate in this stuff.
Obama's a peacemaker, and that's been his push from the beginning. Even Baker yesterday, James Baker, admitted that Obama's small footprint in Syria was the right thing to do. That not putting boots on the ground, not getting involved in Syria, not getting involved in Yemen with boots on the ground, has been a very, very wise thing to do. That's coming from a very, very conservative.
And now
Republican.
They're saying that the solution was to put more boots on the ground, get us more involved in the Yemeni civil war, and get more involved in the Syrian civil war, where there's really nobody that we should be supporting
in the war.
They're
saying both things are.
Or there's so very few people.
They're saying, get involved, well, let them fight it out. You know what I mean? It's crazy. From the same party, you're hearing both philosophies.
What you need to do is work for peace. Join us next week. Mike's suggesting that we talk about what, Mike, next week on the show?
The 2016 election, no matter, because of the way elections are now, it's absurd to be but it's influencing how we live every day now. So I'd like to talk about the 2016 election. We already made reference to it.
It gives me a headache, Mike.
It's because it's so early. You know, why are we talking about the 2016 election? I mean, Hillary hasn't
It makes my head hurt. It really does, Mike. I talk about Hillary and Jeb Bush. I mean,
we already have announced candidates.
We're going to talk about everybody. We're not just going to talk about those. So we got lots of people to talk about, and we got lots of Democrats to talk about. Tune in next week, folks, to see everybody say, well, what Democrat? I'll tell you some Democrats that are going to ruffle Hillary's hair. I don't think she has fun.
In a word from our sponsors, we don't want to leave out that we're sponsored by Democrats of the Red Rocks and Democrats of the Verde Valley. And we have a movie coming up tomorrow night, right?
Yes, we do at the public library.
It sounds
like a good one. Yeah.
It's called Doctored.
And
our breakfast?
Dora has a breakfast on the 17th of April, and it'll have Alexander Solar, who's the executive director of the ACLU in Arizona.
Please come.
She's a really great speaker.
Democrats at Red Rocks sponsor these speakers. If you're looking for a little intellectual stimulation here in Sedona, once a month at the old Sedona
Bar and Grill,
we have these wonderful breakfasts, these wonderful speakers that come. The breakfasts are good. The speakers are good. This lady has been to Sedona before.
She's been up here three or four times.
Right. If you go to the website and you're saying, "Well, I don't remember," as soon as you see her,
and she's great on questions. If you have questions,
Look at the state. A great look at the whole state.
This show and all our shows will be available on podcast on
VBID.org. VBID.org.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.